In this presentation, we'll be looking at Philippians chapter 2, the first six verses. It's one of the most beautiful passages in the New Testament. So Paul writes to this community that he's very fond of and very close to. He says, if there's any appeal in the Messiah, any consolation from love, any communion in the Spirit, any movements of compassion and feelings of love, make my joy complete. We've had occasion to observe Paul's affectionate nature and his capacity for deep friendship. His close communion with the risen Jesus also stands out in everything he writes. Rarely do these two aspects of Paul's character come together as beautifully as in this passage. He's spoken of the need to support each other in the faith, in the face of opposition coming from outside the community. Now, he appeals to the Christians in Philippi to do all they can to deepen communion within the community. He begins his appeal by speaking of four aspects of the life which they enjoy as disciples of Jesus. The first is the way in which Christ himself continues to appeal to them to live a life of love. The Greek paraklesis has many nuances, including encouragement and comfort. It often means appeal, and that seems to suit the present context best. Jesus, he told the Galatians, gave himself for us. And from the heart of the risen Jesus comes the Spirit through whom God's love is poured into our hearts. Jesus gives us his Spirit so that we might enjoy his own communion with God and so with each other. He continues to appeal to us to live in the communion of love for which he gave his life. And so he says, if there's any appeal in the Messiah, and he goes on, any consolation from love, any communion in the Spirit, any movements of compassion and feelings of love. Consolation. It's the consolation that comes from loving and being loved. He's referring to God's love, which they continue to receive from Jesus in any number of unexpected ways. He's thinking especially of the comfort which they receive from Christ through the love of other Christians. Speaks of consolation from love, and he goes on, communion in the Spirit. The communion which they enjoy in the Spirit. Communion with the risen Christ, and so with the Father, and communion with those who share their faith. He speaks of movements of compassion, which they experience, and feelings of love. He's thinking of the mercies of God and the compassion and love of the heart of Jesus, especially as these are mediated to us through other members of the Christian community. He prays, make my joy complete. Be of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord and of one mind. Paul urges the Philippians to be of one mind, and one mind to be in tune with each other in their thinking, in their feelings, in their attitudes. He wants them to experience the same love, the love of the heart of Jesus, drawing them into ever more intimate communion with God, and so with each other. He wants them to be one soul. He wants them to be in full accord. This is what it means to live your life in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. In verse 3, do nothing from selfish ambition. Do not strive after or seek to find your value in things that are worthless. He wants the Philippians to let the special trusting dependence of Christ on his Father find expression in their lives too. Then they would not be tempted to self-centeredness or to striving after things that are worthless. The only glory worth having is a sharing in the glory of the risen Jesus. Then they would have no difficulty in delighting in the gifts which Christ has bestowed on others, in looking up to them and caring for them. As he said to the Corinthians, don't seek your own advantage. Seek that of the other. And he goes on to say in the Corinthians, I try to please everyone in everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, but that of many, so that they may be saved. One of the characteristics of true love is that it does not insist on its own way. That's in 1 Corinthians, in the hymn to love, in chapter 13. And then Paul adds another beautiful quality of this communion. In humility, regard others above yourselves, so that you're not all focused on yourself, but each is looking to the interests of the others. Let the same mind be in you that was in the Messiah, Jesus. At the basis of such selfless love lies humility, which for a disciple of Christ has nothing to do with belittling oneself. It's the recognition of oneself as a child of God, and includes the trust that one's true self will be cared for by God's love. The only way to grow in this virtue, humility, as in the others, is to receive it from the one who said, learn from me, I'm gentle and humble in heart. Matthew 11:29. The Greek word we're translating here as humility, it denotes thinking of oneself as being low. The word for humility is tapenophrosune, and the word for low is tapenos. So that's the basic of it. In ordinary Greek usage, outside the Bible, being in a low state is considered undesirable. To be reduced to such a state by people or by the gods is to suffer an evil fate. At the same time, since in relation to the gods, the Greek philosophers, one is necessarily low, to refuse to accept our lowly condition is to fall into the vice of pride. To accept one's low position in relation to the gods, and even in relation to other people, when fate has so willed it, this is their understanding, it's considered sensible and virtuous. The Greek Old Testament mirrors non-biblical Greek with one important qualification, which reflects Israel's understanding of itself as a religious people born out of the Exodus event. Central to Israel's self-understanding is that God has redeemed them from their low condition in Egypt. Being low has no value in itself, but it does attract God's compassionate love, and it does hold out hope for liberation. The following text from Isaiah is typical. In chapter 49 he writes, "Sing for joy, O heavens, exult, O earth, break forth, O mountains, into singing, for the Lord has comforted his people and will have compassion on his lowly ones." Tapenos. Sirach recommends lowering oneself before God. "They who fear the Lord," he writes, "keep their hearts prepared and bow down their souls in God's presence." Greek moral philosophy outside the Bible has no place for humility, no place for thinking of oneself as low. In fact, the word humility, tapenophrosune, doesn't occur in Greek prior to Paul. Shortly after Paul, we find it being used by Plutarch, Epictetus, and Josephus. But it's always a vice, never a virtue. As they use the word, it's best translated small-minded, mean-spirited. It's the equivalent of having a low self-esteem. In the Greek Old Testament, the related adjective occurs only once. It's in Proverbs 29:23. "A person's pride," writes the author, "will bring humiliation, but one who is lowly in spirit will obtain honor." That's the only use. They never use the noun, but it's the only use of the adjective related to it. The related verb also occurs only once in the Greek Old Testament, in a text which prepares us for its use in the New Testament. It's Psalm 131. It reads, "O Lord, my heart is not lifted up, my eyes are not raised too high. I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvelous for me. I've calmed and quieted my soul." That's a translation of the original Hebrew. The Greek translation, where the Hebrew has calmed, reads, "I think of myself humbly." It's the verb related to the word for humility. I think of myself humbly, and I've quieted my soul like a weaned child with its mother. My soul is like the weaned child that is with me. O Israel, hope in the Lord from this time on and forevermore. In the New Testament now, like Sirach, it calls upon people to lower themselves before God. Recall the statement of Jesus, all who exalt themselves will be humbled. All who lower themselves will be lifted up, exalted. That's the word tepenos and the other parts of the word. The following scene from the Gospel recalls Psalm 131. At that time, we're told, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" Jesus called a child, whom he put among them, and he said, "Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like children, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever becomes lowly like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." The little child is offered as a symbol of humility, for it beautifully captures Jesus' own childlike trust in the God whom he calls Abba. He wants his disciples to have a heart that's humble like his. Because Jesus looked up to God in loving trust, he was able to look up to everyone, delighting in people with the delight that belongs to the innocence of childhood and experiencing it as a privilege to serve them. All this provides the background to the virtue which appears for the first time in the Greek language in Paul. Thinking of oneself as low. That is what humility is. It's an attitude of mind and heart that recognizes oneself as God's child, sharing the life of God's Son, and therefore living in total dependence on God. The humble person delights in this dependence, knowing that God is a father and can be absolutely counted on as a source of life, love, and hope. As touched on earlier, in the Greek and Roman world, it was considered a virtue to recognize one's low position in regard to the gods. It was right not to exaggerate one's own importance or to strive beyond one's fate. But the self held a central place in their ethics. They thought of their individual nature as sharing in the divinity. The divine in each person was thought of as identified with the self. It was important, therefore, to the moralists in the Greek and Roman worlds to recognize and respect oneself and not to think of oneself in a servile way. For the Christian, the divine spirit which sanctifies the self is the spirit of Jesus. Paul, it's no longer I who live, it's the Messiah who is living in me. To know how to obey the divine will, Christians do do not look to their own nature and strive to act accordingly. Rather, they listen attentively to the call of the Lord, and they strive to be obedient to one in whose wisdom and love they trust. Christians experience a radical and liberating change of perspective. As Paul says to the Corinthians, if anyone is in the Messiah, there's a new creation. In this new creation, humility is a basic virtue. Everything now is possible, not to the one who's most self-sufficient, but for one who believes. The self is no less important, but perfection for the self is a flowering of the gifts of the Spirit. And the way to this perfection is in self-giving after the example of Jesus and by the power of his Spirit. As he says, those who try to make their life secure will lose it. It's those who lose their life who will keep it. Humility as a Christian virtue is a sharing in the life of Jesus, the child of God, and in the intimacy of his trust in his Father. This call to humility provides the setting for the following verses. To see what humility is, we need to contemplate Jesus. And in the last verse that we'll comment on in this presentation, verse 6, Paul, having appealed to them, says, the Messiah Jesus, being in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be grasped. He begins by speaking of Jesus as being in the form of God. The Greek for form is morphe. It then introduces the concept of equality with God. For Paul the monotheist, there's one God, the Father. No one can be equal to God. The concept only occurs in one other place in the New Testament, where Jesus' opponents accuse him of making yourself equal to God. That's in John chapter 5, verse 18. Jesus denies this, asserting his complete dependence on God, his Father. Since it's John who makes this point so clearly in his Gospel, let us explore John's approach to this. There's a scene in chapter 5, verse 16 to 18 of John's Gospel, and I'll read it to you. The Jews started persecuting Jesus because he was doing such things. He just healed a man at the pool of Bethsaida on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, my Father's still working, and I also am working. And John continues, for this reason, the Jews were seeking all the more to kill Jesus, because he was not only breaking the Sabbath, but was also calling God his own Father, thereby making himself equal to God. That's the accusation, no doubt, that the Jewish community were making of the Christians as the first century developed. Jesus was making himself equal to God. The Christian community was treating Jesus as though he was equal to God. The intimacy Jesus experienced in his relationship with God is central to Christianity. Christians, including the community of the beloved disciple, John, saw Jesus as the perfect human expression, the incarnation of God, who reveals God as love. However, their experience was interpreted by outsiders. They vigorously opposed the misinterpretation that Christians thought of Jesus as equal to God. Jesus is claiming to be one with God, whom he calls my Father, because he knows God, and he knows too the perfect communion of love that he's enjoying with God. He wants to share this communion with us. Far from claiming to be equal to God, Jesus knows he can do nothing apart from God, on whom he utterly depends for who he is and for everything he says or does. In that same chapter 5, verse 19 to 20, the Gospel reads, Jesus said to them, "Very truly I tell you, the Son can do nothing on his own, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, the Son does likewise. The Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing." The Christian understanding of the nature of the relationship between Jesus and God is so important to John that we'll pause here to meditate on the many statements he places on Jesus' lips that take us to the heart of Jesus' prayer communion. And you'll see that in none of them is Jesus claiming to be equal to God. I'll simply read the texts. Firstly, Jesus knows and reveals God. John chapter 1, verse 18. No one's ever seen God. It's the only Son who's in the bosom of the Father who has made God known. In chapter 10, verse 15, the Father knows me. I know the Father. The Father loves me. In chapter 3, verse 16, with the chorus commenting on that scene says, God so loved the world that he gave his only Son so that everyone who believes in him may have eternal life. And now other texts. The one who comes from heaven testifies to what he's seen and heard. This is indeed the will of my Father, that all who see the Son and believe in him may have eternal life. And again, the one who's from God has seen the Father. The living Father who sent me, he sent me, and I live because of the Father. That's what Jesus is claiming. I know him, he says. I'm from him, He sent me. And also in the Gospel of John, if you knew me, you would know my Father also. And again, I know my own know me, as the Father knows me, and I know the Father. The Father and I are one. And in chapter 14, do you not believe that I'm in the Father and the Father is in me? The words I say to you, I do not speak as from myself. It's the Father living in me who is doing this work. You must believe me when I say that I'm in the Father. The Father is in me. Believe me on the evidence of what I'm doing, if for no other reason. All those 20 or so texts are showing us that in Jesus' consciousness, it's God who's sending him on mission, and everything he is and does is revealing God. Here's some more texts from John. Jesus doesn't speak his own words. The words he speaks come from his prayer, from his communion with God. Quoting from the Gospel, he whom God has sent speaks the words of God. He gives the Spirit without measure. My teaching, he says, is not mine, it's his who sent me. Anyone who resolves to do the will of God will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I'm speaking on my own. I declare to the world what I've heard from God. I speak these things as the Father instructs me. He's listening to God and speaking what God moves him to speak. As he says in chapter 8, I declare what I've seen in the Father's presence. You're trying to kill me, a man who's told you the truth. The truth that I heard from God. I know him, he says, and I keep his word. Do you not believe that I'm in the Father and the Father is in me? The words I say to you, I don't speak as from myself. The word that you hear is not mine. It's from the Father who sent me. And in his prayer at the Last Supper to God, chapter 17, the words you gave to me, I've given to them, and they've received them, and know in truth that I came from you, and they have believed that you sent me. All his words come from his intimate communion with God. Far from claiming equality with God, Jesus is rejoicing in the constant gift that God gives Jesus of God's own self. That's his words. Here's many more texts too from the same Gospel of John. Jesus doesn't carry out his own actions. He's doing what his Father commissions him to do. Quoting from John's Gospel, Jesus said to them, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to complete his work. My Father, he said, is still working, and I also am working. And again, the Son can do nothing on his own. He only does what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, the Son does likewise. The Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing. And again, I've come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of the one who sent me. I do nothing on my own. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is just because I seek to do not my own will, but the will of the one who sent me. The deeds that the Father has given me to complete, the very deeds that I'm doing, testify on my behalf that the Father has sent me. When you've lifted up the Son of Man, you will realize that I am, and that I do nothing on my own. The one who sent me is with me. He hasn't left me alone. I always do what pleases him. There's no independence. There's no rivalry. There's no being equal to God. There's just a heart that is perfectly listening and obedient and loves to share God's words that he's learnt in prayer with others and to do what he's inspired by the Spirit of God to do. He says, it's the Father living in me who's doing this work. And again, I glorified you, Father, on earth by finishing the work you gave me to do. Jesus cried out, we're told, whoever believes in me believes not in me, but in the one who sent me. And whoever sees me sees the one who sent me. I've come as light into the world, so that everyone who believes in me should not remain in darkness. And so, back to Philippians chapter 2, verse 6. The Messiah, Jesus, being in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be grasped. Some translators interpret this as saying that Christ didn't consider being equal to God as something to be exploited. They see in this verse a reference to the pre-existent Christ who chose to become human rather than use his divinity for his own advantage. It's a most unlikely translation. The word for grasped is harpagmos. Though harpagmos is not found in any other text in the Greek Bible, the related verb harpazo is found in both Septuagint and the New Testament, and always with the idea of grasping something forcibly. If we interpret it along these lines, Paul is contemplating Jesus as humbly accepting the reality of the human condition and living in complete dependence on the Father. This fits with John's understanding of Jesus' relationship with God. In the light of Paul's portraying of Jesus as the new Adam, he may also be saying that whereas Adam grasped at the forbidden fruit in his desire to be like God, Jesus remained faithful and obedient. He accepted to depend on God in loving trust. As he says, the Son can do nothing on his own. In this way, Jesus showed us what it means to be human. This is the new Adam who doesn't reach up to grasp at something to make it his own, equality with God. This is how man should be, humbly delighting in being loved and graced. If this is the direction of Paul's thought, what does he mean by the expression being in the form of God? The thought seems to be the same as that expressed in John's Gospel when Philip says to Jesus, "Show us the Father and we shall be satisfied." And Jesus replies, "Whoever has seen me has seen the Father." A being can be manifest in a number of different ways. When the form changes, we borrow the Greek word used here, morphē, by speaking of a metamorphosis, a change of form. Paul's reminding us that when we look at Jesus, we're seeing how God chose to reveal God's self in human form. The whole of creation is a manifestation, a radiance, a form of God. It's precisely because of this fact that Jesus chose to live and to die in the manner in which Paul goes on to describe. Paul is speaking of Jesus in this way to remind us of what we're all called to be. By communion with Jesus, we're called to undergo a transformation till we can say with Paul, "It's no longer I who live, it's the Messiah who lives in me." Paul goes on to say, "My little children, for whom I'm again in the pain of childbirth until the Messiah is formed in you." Same word, morpho, formed in you. We're to be transformed, and that's the word metamorphosis, by a renewal of mind in Romans 12:2. As Paul says to the Corinthians, all of us, with unveiled faces, seeing the glory of the Lord as though reflected in a mirror, we're being transformed, it's the same word, into the same image. We're being transformed into the form of God that we see in Jesus. From one degree of glory to another. And all of this comes from the Lord, the Spirit. That most beautiful statement is from Paul's second letter to the Corinthians, chapter 3, verse 18. So let me conclude this rich six verses of Paul by just reading them now without comment from verse 1 through to verse 6. And we'll pick up verse 7 where it all continues in the next presentation. In chapter 2, verse 1 to 6, Paul writes, "If there's any appeal in the Messiah, any consolation from love, any communion in the Spirit, any movements of compassion and feelings of love, make my joy complete. Do nothing from selfish ambition. Do not strive after or seek to find your value in things that are worthless. In humility, regard others above yourselves, so that you're not all focused on yourself, but each is looking to the interest of the others. Let the same mind be in you that was in the Messiah, Jesus." And then he begins this hymn. The Messiah Jesus, being in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be grasped. How he did look on God and himself, Paul will continue in verse 7.